But they could both be wrong, Rezkin added.
The others fell silent as they walked, presumably to contemplate his statement. Finally, Frischer said,
You are intentionally confusing us.
Yes, he replied. Changing the subject, he asked Farson, Why are you here? You should be in the ward with the others.
The majors could not keep that type of ward active for so long. It fell a while ago, replaced with something less threatening. We've been taking turns scouting in case we needed to prepare for another ambush or you required assistance. The camp has been moved to a better location. It is just around this bend.
Farson snuck back into the darkness, and Rezkin strode into what appeared, from outside the ward, to be a dark camp. Once he crossed the threshold, however, he was surrounded by ethereal light emitted by blue fluorescent swirls dancing across the interior surface of the ward. He was followed by Frischer and Zah, whom most of the others still knew as Luss.
Frischer?
Malthus exclaimed.
What are you doing here? You were supposed to be waiting on the ship.
Frischer huffed.
I was, until a group of assassins swarmed the ship and kidnapped us.
See?
Malthus snapped.
This is why you should not have come.
You're going to blame this on me, Frischer said.
She balled her fists.
You know what your problem is, Malthus? You always blame the people you're supposed to care about for everything bad that happens.
Malthus stomped toward her.
That is because the people I care about keep getting themselves into trouble.
Frischer's retort died on her lips as Rezkin whipped the veil from his hips and began dressing. Malthus said,
Rezkin, must you do that here? There are women.
Oh, no, he's fine, Raylan said. We don't mind.
Rezkin looked at Malthus as he strapped a few previously hidden knives to his legs, knowing he would have to adjust them later so his opponents would not know their exact locations. He said, You would prefer I go outside the protective ward to dress?
No, I guess not, but they
have already seen. If they do not wish to see more, they may look away. Malthus stormed over to Isaria, who was seated beside Raylan, and said,
You are a knight! Have you no decorum?
Isaria bounded to her feet to meet Malthus's hostile stance.
Firstly, Malthus Jabai, my oath said nothing about not watching a man dress. And secondly, it is none of your business where I look.
Malthus fumed as he stormed to the edge of the ward and sat with his back to the group behind the rock on which Brant was sitting. Shazar stepped closer to Rezkin and said, That one is always angry. Yes, Rezkin said as he pulled on his pants. The striker said, It will get him killed. Probably, Rezkin replied. We should counsel him. You may try, but I believe this is something he must work through for himself. Then again, I have difficulty understanding these outworlders at times. I could be wrong. I have not yet known you to be wrong, Shazar said with a smirk. Rezkin strapped on his sword belt and replied, I am often wrong. I simply choose not to speak of it to others. With an edge of frustration in his tone, he said, I was wrong about what Prithith would want, and now we are stuck going to Lun-Laresh. The sword is in Lun-Laresh? No, it is not. We are set to yet another task. They want Oladia.
Who is Oladia?
Raylan asked, obviously having been paying as much attention to their conversation as she was Rezkin's body. Queen Asariel's daughter.
Another princess,
she exclaimed. She is not a princess, Rezkin said. In Lun-Laresh, the crown is not passed down the family line, and the offspring of the rulers bear no more power or respect than any other member of a powerful house. Lun-Laresh is ruled by women. The women are the heads of the houses, and they maintain and control all matters of politics, business, and the personal lives of the members of their houses. For a woman to climb the social ladder, she must defeat someone higher than her, either through financial, political, or physical means. Accepted methods of defeat in specific matters are strictly governed by cultural tradition. To become queen, a woman must kill the sitting ruler. Raylan said,
So any woman can assassinate the queen and claim the throne?
Technically, yes, but she would not remain queen for long. If she does not have the support and strength of the highest houses behind her, she will likely be killed by a rival. You have played Queen's Gambit?
Yes. My father taught me when I was a child, Raylan said. I hate it.
It came from Lun-Laresh. It is a game of strategy best won when your opponent cannot make any moves against you without destroying him or herself. When played with multiple players, one must manipulate the board,
so that any move by any player will be harmful to the other players. The player in the lead takes the crest, and the other players are relegated to fighting each other to remain in the game.
I know, Raylan huffed. I never win. Either a player has to sacrifice herself for someone else to have a chance, or the other players gang up on someone, which was always me, by the way.
I wonder why, Frisha muttered.
Rezkin said, The Crown of Lonnoresh is won in much the same way as the game. It might be easily gained through murder, but it is not easily kept. Queen Asseriel has worn the crown for 6 years, which is a long time by Lareshi standards.
Malsius glared at Isseria as he stood to join them and said,
What you are saying is that the Lareshi are a bunch of conniving, backstabbing women who are not to be trusted.
He looked at Rezkin.
Great. When do we go?
You will stay with the other men on the ship. I will go alone with Isseria, Raylan, and Mage Threl.
That is absurd, Malsius exclaimed.
Yes, it is, Farson said as he stomped through the ward. She is not going in there alone.
Shazar also spoke up.
I am prepared to stand at your side.
Rezkin looked between the two strikers skeptically. You two desire to go into Lonnoresh? Both shifted uncomfortably, and Shazar said,
I do not desire to go there, but I will suffer the consequences to serve my king.
And I will not let my niece go alone, Farson said.
She will not be alone. Knight Isseria and Raylan will be with her, and she is a capable mage in her own right. You, however, will be a liability.
I will go,
Wesson said. Rezkin looked at him in surprise. You understand the danger?
Wesson scratched his head and shrugged. So long as they do not know the strength of my power, I think I will be okay. I'm not exactly their type.
Malsius exclaimed,
What are you all talking about? Why would you take them and leave us behind?
Rezkin said, I told you, Malsius, women rule in Lonnoresh. Any woman may claim any man as her consort.
You mean as her husband?
No. It is extremely rare for a woman to declare a man to be a husband. To do so would mean that she recognizes him as her equal, and he would have the right to claim half her property and engage in business on behalf of the house. A consort has none of those rights. He is her companion, lover, and sometimes champion, but he is not her equal.
So he is her slave?
Malsius said with disgust.
Isseria said, No. Men hold the same position in Lonnoresh that women do in Gandishan and most of the other kingdoms, including Ashai.
It sounds like slavery to me, he said.
It does, doesn't it? She snapped.
It is the accepted culture in Lonnoresh, Rezkin said. Men vie for positions as consort to powerful women, conduct most of the activities requiring physical labor, and serve in the military. Men unsuited to physical labor raise the male offspring and perform domestic chores.
So, any woman can claim a man. What if he is already taken or does not wish to be claimed?
The woman to whom the consort belongs is called his matria. If he has not been claimed, he belongs to his head of house, or matria nera, which would be his highest-ranking female relative. If a woman attempts to claim a Lareshi man, his matria has the right to challenge the claim. The matria may make a financial deal if the exchange is accepted, or she may name terms for a duel. The matria will name a champion, which may be the man in question if he does not accept the claim, and the challenger will also name a champion, usually a male from her household or another of her consorts. The terms of the duel are determined by the matria being challenged. If the challenger does not agree to the terms, she may withdraw her claim.
Wait, Raylan said. You said another consort?
Yes, it is not uncommon for a woman to claim more than one consort, but more than three is frowned upon, and they are usually of varying stations. A woman attempting to claim too many high-ranking men would be considered greedy. She would lose the support of her peers, which, as we have said, is vital to her staying in power.
What if a man wants to claim a woman? Malsius said.
It is not permitted. If he has a good relationship with his matria nera, he can request that she approach a woman to determine her interest, and they may negotiate a contract in much the same way as is done for betrothals in Ashai. A dowry may be offered on his behalf. You must keep in mind, though, that if a woman does not desire a man who belongs to her, she may sell or trade him to someone else. The women in lower society often claim many men to use as workers. A woman is expected to provide for her men, though, and his quality of life should be at least equal to his station.
But we are not Lurishi,
Malsius protested. Foreigners are not exempt from their laws, Malsius, just as they are not exempt from those in Ashai. There are certain agreements, though, to keep the peace. Foreigners can be claimed, but they cannot be forced to stay in Lonlaresh. Men who are already married in another kingdom are exempt, since their wives are not present to accept the challenge. Also, sailors and travelers cannot be claimed so long as they stay within the designated dock area. It does not matter your station. If you do not satisfy those conditions, you may be claimed. The only exception is royalty. A member of a foreign royal family may not be claimed.
So that is why you can go, said Malsius.
Rezkin glanced at Shazar and Farson. Perhaps.
Malsius said, What do you mean? What is the problem?
Shazar said, Lonlaresh has not recognized his claim to Ashai or Kyle. They may not grant him the royal privilege.
Frisher said, But he is the son of—
That is not common knowledge, Farson said with a pointed look.
Frisher crossed her arms and said,
Well, why is Wesson unconcerned? Are mages exempt?
No, Wesson said. It is just that, from what I've heard, I'm not their type. They prefer men like the Strikers or Rezkin. You see, the women are concerned with status, and the strength and masculinity of their men is most important. I do not exactly fit the profile.
Men like Rezkin,
Frisher said. She crossed her arms and lifted her chin.
Fine. If the other women are going, then I am too.
You cannot go, Malsius snapped. I am your escort, and I am not going to be claimed by anyone. You are staying on the ship with me.
Isaria looked at Malsius and said,
I am sure you have little to worry about. You heard the mage. You are not their type.
As the conversation devolved, a thought occurred to Rezkin. He turned to Farson and said, Why did you return from scouting so quickly?
Farson watched the heated exchange between Malsius and Isaria, which was shortly joined by Frisha and Raylan, who tried to drag Mage Threl into the fray. He shook his head and said,
Because we are surrounded.
Rezkin nodded. Surrounded by what?
Wesson had taken refuge from the argument by moving to join them.
The Urals, said Farson.
Lord Malsius is either brave or stupid,
Shazar muttered as he watched the drama unfold.
He turned to Farson and asked, How many?
Perhaps 50. They're difficult to see in the dark. It could be 100.
Do you think we can wait them out?
Wesson said.
Perhaps they will lose interest.
I doubt it, Farson replied. They look hungry. Also, something is strange with their eyes.
Are they black?
Rezkin said.
Yes. How did you know?
In Gendishan, the Uqar driving the Droglics had black eyes. It seemed unnatural, and the way he threw them against us made no sense.
Why did you not say anything?
Rule 3.
Farson sighed.
That does not apply when the information may be important to the group.
Rezkin shook his head. It was not important until now, and now it has been revealed.
Shazar surveyed the darkness outside the glowing ward, but the light made it difficult.
You think they are being driven? They are enchanted?
The Adonoro?
Said Wesson.
Rezkin said, I do not believe it is the Adonoro. But I do think they are under someone's influence.
What makes you think that?
Said Wesson.
The cat at my feet.
The others looked down to see Rezkin's cat sitting patiently as it watched the women berate Malsius. The young lord was not backing down.
What is your cat doing here?
Wesson said in alarm.
Rezkin looked at him and said, It is not my cat.
All of them eyed the creature warily.
That is the same cat that appeared when the Droglics attacked,
Farson said.
And I saw it at the plantation, too, said Wesson.
The cat flicked its tail and blinked up at them without concern.
Is it a familiar?
Shazar said.
Have you bonded with it?
Not as such, Rezkin said. But I do believe it is warning us of the impending danger. The cat looked up at him, licked its lips, and then ran through the ward into the darkness.
We should engage them now while we are awake, Shazar said. The mages may drop the ward if they become too tired or run low on Vimara. If we fight the Vurals now, we will be able to recover while we sleep.
Rezkin motioned to the group that looked to be ready to draw swords and said,
Very well. It is your plan. You get to break that up and prepare them.
The attack came swiftly after Wesson and Nanasi dropped the ward. Dozens of dark shadows shifted in the moonlight, their claws and fangs glinting brightly as they attacked. Wesson released a stream of flame at the front line, and then Nanasi followed it with a trail of water she had wrestled from the stream. When the water met the fire, it turned to boiling steam that cooked and blinded their attackers. The two mages tossed fireballs and caused rocks to explode in the densest gatherings, but the Vurals were fast and agile. They appeared as a mix between a wolf and a large cat, with black and gray fur and sharp fangs that extended below their lower jaws. Moving with feline agility, they blended with the dark rocks around the party until ready to pounce. They attacked in numbers, with several creatures jumping on a single person. Malsius crashed into Frisia as a Vural jumped at him. He was trapped beneath the beast and Frisia beneath him. Suddenly, Lus appeared above the creature. He drove his sword down through the back of the creature's skull. Frisia screamed as the combined weight of Malsius and the massive creature threatened to crush her. Lus shoved the monster off them, and then leapt over their heads to fend off another. Isaria reached down and grabbed Malsius, helping him to his feet. She said, "Stop lying around, you lazy oaf!" She raised her sword to slash the abdomen of a leaping Vural, and Malsius ducked beneath her to score a second across its face. Then Brandt charged in from the other side to stab it through the ribs. "If I were lying around, it would not be with one of these things," said Malsius.
"I've seen you lay with worse," said Brandt.
"I told you, stop fantasizing about me," said Malsius. "Look," said Isaria, pointing to a shelf where several Vurals were gathered, ready to pounce en masse. Wesson shoved his way between them and thrust his hands forward as he released a spell that streaked through the air like lightning. It struck the base of the shelf, sending vibrations through the rocks, causing them to fracture. The shelf broke away from the cliff, the backside dropping first so that the front collapsed on top of the creatures. Malsius said,
"I'm glad you have a steady countenance, journeyman."
Wesson did not reply, but rushed away to lob fireballs at several more creatures. Shazar leaned over Malsius as he stabbed a Vural through the eye.
"You should take a lesson from him and learn some control."
Malsius leapt forward when he saw Brandt go down. One of the Vurals raked its massive claws across Brandt's torso. His screams seemed to excite the beast to a frenzy. Malsius lopped off its tail and then its jaw when it turned on him. By the time the battle was over, everyone had suffered deep punctures and lacerations from teeth and claws. Everyone except Frisia, who was curled beneath a small personal ward that Wesson somehow maintained while also engaging the beasts. While Raylan did not overtly complain about performing her duties as healer, her voice still held an edge as she politely asked people to hold still. Brant's injuries were by far the worst, and Raylan was fairly drained by the time she had finished with everyone.
"Why were there so many?"
Malsius said as he attempted to tie the tattered pieces of his tunic to cover himself. Wesson took a long gulp from his water skin and said,
"They are believed to be Vemoral creatures, a hybrid species created by mages long ago. Vurals live in small packs in the desert. They will attack a lone man but usually avoid groups. Vemoral creatures are often attracted to Vemara, though, so they were probably drawn here in number by the ward we were using to protect ourselves from the Adonal Row."
A heavy rumbling reached their ears, echoing through the canyon from an unknown distance. Rezkin turned his gaze to the stars. Those directly overhead were now obscured by a filmy haze, the more distant lights having disappeared. In that empty darkness, the black silhouette of clouds appeared and disappeared as light crackled within them. He sighed and turned to his companions.
"No sleep is to be had tonight. We must vacate this canyon before we are washed away."
Despite the protests of his companions, he grabbed his pack and began the hazardous walk in the dark. Nanasi set tiny floating sparks like fireflies hovering over the trail to light their way, while Wesson set a weak ward to trail them, claiming it would at least prevent a stray Vural from pouncing on his back.
"But it isn't raining yet,"
Raylan said as she crouched and stumbled over the scree.
"Not here," Shazar said, "but it is out there on the higher ground. The rain will fall afar and flood through the canyon in a torrent."
Raylan said,
"I hate Pharrell."
Malsius snagged his pant leg on a horrid, spindly plant with thorns longer than his thumbnail. He hissed as one of the spikes dug into his calf.
"Ah, for once, you and I are in agreement."
Chapter 9 The trip to Kjellin the capital of Lanlaresh, was not much better than their previous voyage. The autumn storms were terrible, and the Bay of Bordeaux was particularly choppy as it was stirred by inundations from its multiple tributaries. The rain had waned for a short time as the ship approached port, and the travelers could see, even in the gloom of the overcast sky, that Kjellin was a rich city, awash in vibrant colors. Unusually tall buildings sometimes reached 5 or 6 stories, as if they were competing to touch the stars. They were painted in brilliant crimson, indigo, and purple, and every sill, frame, and ledge of even the smallest hovel appeared gilded. Most of the windows had no glass, and the shutters were left open to the cool sea breeze. In these open portals, colorful sheer curtains pranced on drafts over streets and alleys, and beside them, vines clung to the facade from rooftop gardens overgrown with flowering plants and trees. The Gendishan often claimed that Lanlaresh had intentionally appropriated everything garish despite their neighbors, but the Lareshi philosophy was to express passion in every aspect of life, from art and decor to business and war. The docks were no different. Every worker wore a uniform to indicate his or her position, and the ground was marked in colored paint to indicate the appropriate paths for the movement of people, goods, and animals. While most ports tended toward organized chaos, the Lareshi ports had a militaristic order that Rezkin could appreciate. He turned from the view and entered the cabin where Isaria, Raylan, Mage Threl, and Wesson were waiting. Malcius stood by the door watching for the signals. Rezkin collected a small box from one of his trunks, removed its contents, and then stopped in front of Isaria. He held the item up for her inspection. "You will wear this," he said. The sunlight streaming through the porthole glinted off a gold and silver torque. Isaria's eyes widened as her gaze traced the brilliant gold setting that wrapped around a massive tourmaline. On either side of the central stone were smaller sapphires and amethysts.
It's beautiful, she said.
As he fastened it around her neck, Rezkin said, "It once belonged to Matrianera Geraldina. It is considered to be a famous work of art, both for its beauty and the story it holds. I stole it from the Adonna Row. It is now yours."
"What?"
Isaria blurted.
"Why would you give me something stolen from the Adonna Row?"
"Yes, Rezkin,"
Malcius said angrily.
"Why are you giving Isaria expensive jewelry?"
Rezkin closed the box, returned it to the trunk, and then turned to Isaria to explain. Matrianera Geraldina was the head of a powerful house during the last reign. The torque was stolen by her consort, who used it to pay the Adonna Row to kill her. But Geraldina found out about the plan and killed him and his male children, both her own and those from a previous Matria. The Adonna Row killed Geraldina anyway and kept the torque as payment. You will let it be known that the torque was a gift from me, which serves two purposes. Bestowing knighthood on you demonstrated that I value your skills and accomplishments, but gifting you this torque shows that I value you as a woman. Appearances are important to the Lareshi. A worthy male will make his appreciation known by gifting luxuries to his woman.
But she is not your woman,
Malcius exclaimed rather too quickly. He appeared discomfited when everyone turned to stare at him. He shook his head and added,
I mean Frisha
is not my woman either, Malcius, nor will she ever be. The betrothal is cancelled. You need to accept that.
What?
Raylan, Nanasi, and Isaria all cried at once. Rezkin was surprised by the group outburst. He said, I thought someone would have mentioned it, since everyone is so eager to discuss my marital status. Isaria cleared her throat.
You said there were two reasons for the torque?
Yes, the second being that the Lareshi will know I acquired it from the Adonna Row. Queen Arisiel is aware that her daughter desires to join them, and she will likely make the connection. It gives my cause legitimacy.
What if the Adonna Row take exception to your stealing it?
Said Wesson. Rezkin shrugged. If they did not wish for me to take the torque, they would have done a better job of holding on to it. Wesson said,
You were not there for long, and I do not imagine they allowed you to roam around looking for things to steal. How did you find this treasure?
Rezkin shook his head as he went to his desk. It was not difficult. The Great Mother was wearing it.
The Great Mother?
Said Wesson. Rezkin looked up at him. Their leader. Isaria tugged at the torque.
You stole this from the neck of the leader of the Adonaro.
She tugged at it again, but it would not budge. Rezkin told her, stop pulling at it. You will hurt yourself. It is enchanted not to come off unless removed by the person who clasped it shut.
But you removed it from the Great Mother,
Wesson observed as he stood to examine the torque.
And you would have to have done it quickly, or she would have noticed.
She was rather distracted, Rezkin replied. Malsius seemed even more frustrated when he said,
I recall that you were nude. Why were you so close to the woman, and how was she distracted?
Lord Malsius!
Mage Threl exclaimed. He appeared slightly abashed until she looked at Rezkin and said,
Where did you hide it?
A whistle, followed by shouts from on deck, signaled that the ship was about to be boarded. A smaller vessel had been escorting theirs since entering Lareshi waters. As soon as both were docked, a woman and two men boarded Stargazer without invitation, a privilege that was apparently reserved for female captains. The men were slight of build and wore loose beige pants that tied at the ankles beneath matching smocks that fell to their knees. Their hair was shorn close to the scalp, and each held stacks of papers and a writing tablet. The woman was a minister of the docks, tasked with inspecting foreign vessels and their cargo. She appeared to be in her late 20s and had straight, brown hair tied back into a tail that hung past her waist. Her eyes and lips were enhanced with powders and paint, and she had multiple rings piercing each ear. She wore a dark brown sleeveless overcoat that was fitted to her curves and crossed her chest to tie at one muscular shoulder. Her voluminous black pants gathered at the knee, leaving her lower legs bare down to her hard-soled slippers. The silky red sash that encircled her hips was tied at the side with the loose end hanging halfway down her thigh. At that moment, she also wore a scowl for the captain.
I am telling you, it is a passenger vessel, said Captain Estad.
The woman glanced around the deck at the recently added weapons and modified rails and said,
It looks like a military vessel to me.
Chazar approached, dressed in his formal black and green regalia. He smiled and genuflected, as was appropriate for a man when addressing a woman of station.
Minister, may I have the privilege of introducing myself and this vessel's occupants?
The woman looked him up and down and smiled appreciatively.
You appear to be a worthy man. You may speak.
Retaining his smile, he bowed again.
This is Stargazer, flagship of the Royal Navy of the Kingdom of Kyle. I am Stryker Chazar in service to the King of Kyle, true King of Ashai. My liege desires a meeting with Queen Arisiel.
The woman scanned the deck again.
I have never heard of the Kingdom of Kyle. Your king does not seem to travel with the usual flair. He has no women to speak for him?
Chazar continued to smile.
He has many women, Minister. They tend to him now. I will inform Royal Knight Isseria that you wish to speak with her.
She looked at him skeptically.
Your king has knighted a woman?
Yes, Chazar said. She is worthy.
Isseria stalked out of the cabin on cue, also wearing her formal uniform, with the addition of the priceless torque. She stopped in front of Chazar and the minister and looked down her nose at the shorter woman.
Of course I am worthy, she said. Was there any doubt?
No, Knight Isseria,
the woman said, shaking her head vigorously.
I was just surprised. I had not heard of a woman being knighted in any of the kingdoms.
Isseria turned and saluted Chazar with a fist over her heart and said,
Thank you, Stryker Chazar, for allowing me the privilege of this duty.
Chazar tilted his head and departed without a backward glance. The minister glanced between Isseria and the striker's retreating form.
He is your superior?
Yes,
said Isseria. The woman's face soured and she huffed.
Why has he delegated this task to one of lower station?
Isseria switched to Lareshi and replied,
Because you desire to speak with a woman.
The minister blinked.
You are Lareshi?
Isseria slapped a fist over the emblem embroidered onto her tabard and said,
I am Kylian.
The woman glanced around skeptically and said,
All right. I will send a message to see if the queen desires a meeting with your king.
Stryker Chazar stalked out of the cabin, flanked by Mage Threl and Raylan on either side. Raylan carried her weapons and was dressed in armor, but her tabard looked like modified healer's robes. The center was gray with silver lining, while the sides were black with a green lightning bolt stitched onto the breast. Looking back at Isseria, the minister said,
The women in your kingdom are encouraged to learn the sword? Even the healers?
Isaria grinned.
Kyle is a warrior kingdom.
I see,
the other woman said. Her gaze flicked to the striker, and she called, Striker Shazar,
you should dine with me. You may visit my home.
She smiled devilishly and added,
It is located only a few streets from the docks.
Shazar turned and bowed. I am honored by the invitation, Minister, but I cannot accept. I am assigned to the security of the ship. She sauntered over to him and ran a finger along his jaw.
If we were not bound by the rules of the dock, I would not give you a choice. I will make it worth your while.
Shazar clasped her hand as he removed it from his face and said,
Tempting, but I am bound by duty.
Pity,
she said. Then her demeanor changed, and she waved as if tossing the invitation away.
It is no matter. There are plenty of men to be had.
She turned back to Isaria and said,
I will need to inspect the ship.
Our king demands diplomatic immunity for his quarters and those of the strikers and myself, but you may examine the rest.
The woman tapped her lip thoughtfully and then spoke to her assistants.
Send a missive to the dock mistress for permission to grant diplomatic immunity.
To Isaria she said,
I doubt you will receive it.
One of the men scribbled a message on his tablet, bowed, and then handed the quill to the minister. After signing the document, the man departed, and she said,
Let us get on with this. Guide the way.
Isaria showed the woman around the deck, and then took her below to examine the other rooms and cargo. By the time they were finished, the dock mistress had arrived to personally assess the situation. She was an older woman with graying hair tied in an intricate braid atop her head. She wore a stern countenance. Her figure was fit, although her skin was darkened and leathery from too many years spent in the sun.
I hear we have an errant king aboard,
said the dock mistress as Isaria and the minister approached.
It seems this one has been making waves across the Suelian. I have heard of this new king, but I will see him before I make my decision.
The minister's eyes widened as dark tidings appeared behind the dock mistress. The older woman turned and jumped as he looked down at her. She was petite beside the towering wraith, and she was wary despite her sour visage.
I am the one you seek, said the unsettling voice.
The woman lifted her chin and said,
Is that so?
Isaria moved to Rezkin's side. Her voice was sharp as she addressed the dock mistress.
This is the king of Kyle, true king of Ashai. You will show him proper respect.
The woman appeared uncertain, but ultimately decided to adhere to diplomatic formalities. She crossed her arms in front of her, palms facing outward, and then touched her forehead to her wrists. The minister followed the dock mistress's example.
I do not wish to be kept waiting,
said Dark Tidings. The woman pursed her lips.
Word has been sent to the palace of your arrival. You are not in your kingdom, she said. You will be apprised of the pertinent laws and customs while we wait.
That is not necessary,
Dark Tidings said.
I am familiar with your laws. My entourage is entirely female, except for the journeyman mage and the priest of the Maker.
He nodded toward Minder Finwy and Wesson, who was doing his best to appear puny and insignificant. The woman scowled and sniffed disdainfully.
Are you sure he is not a girl?
She said. Dark Tidings tilted his head as he made a show of examining the mage. He replied,
No, I am not.
The dark mistress dismissed Wesson and said,
If you are granted a visit with the queen, I will approve your diplomatic immunity. If not, you will be subject to the same search as every other vessel, or you will leave port.
Dark mistress, how long have you held your position?
Said Dark Tidings.
I acquired my position after my predecessor's downfall 5 years ago.
He said,
How many foreign rulers have called to this port in that time?
Well, none that I recall.
No. And I am certain you would remember such an encounter. You need to revisit your lessons in etiquette, lest you meet your predecessor's fate.
The minister, who stood a step behind the dock mistress, eyed her superior hungrily, as if considering how she might make that happen. The dock mistress granted him an insincere smile and said,
I will take your suggestion under advisement. You should expect to receive word within the hour. I will return if you are approved.
The woman bowed slightly and then strode from the deck down the gangplank, followed by her remaining assistant and the minister. The minister marched imperiously past Shazar, not even glancing his way. Once they were gone, Shazar turned to Rezkin and said,
The Lareshi do not take rejection kindly. Rezkin nodded. It is something to keep in mind.
They finished gathering their belongings while they waited. Frisha approached Rezkin when he was finally alone in his cabin, although she had to enlist Zah's assistance in circumventing Malcius to get to him.
What are you looking at? She asked. Surely you have read all of your papers a million times by now.
I took these off the dock, mistress, he said absently as he read.
But I never saw you get close to her, and I was watching from the doorway the entire time.
You were supposed to be in your cabin.
Frisha cleared her throat to get his attention and said,
I think I should go.
Without the slightest hesitation, he said, no.
But Raylan is going.
With the look he gave her, she did not bother to finish the thought. She bit her bottom lip and then started.
The O'Donnell wrote...
He glanced up, his gaze sharpening as he waited for her to finish.
They offered to teach me. They said I could join them.
No, he said again. With an embittered expression, she crossed her arms and huffed.
Why not? You said I can choose what I want to be. You don't even discuss it. You just say no.
You are not a warrior, Frisha. You have said as much.
I could be. I'm not weak, you know.
She lifted her chin.
I can be just as strong as Isaria.
Rezkin rounded the desk and leaned against it as he gave her his full attention.
No one said you are not strong. You do not have to be a warrior to be strong.
If I were a warrior, I would be someone you could respect.
I do respect you, he said.
Frisha huffed again.
The O'Donnell robe protect the innocent. It seems like a worthy cause.
Rezkin rose quickly and was in front of her before she could blink. He captivated her with his crystal blue gaze.
Do not deceive yourself. The Adonaro live in darkness. They do dark things to protect the light. You may choose your path, Frisha. If it is what you wish, I will not stop you.
He traced a finger over her cheek.
I did not understand why outworlders would choose to remain oblivious, vulnerable. But you have shown me something I had never seen, something of value. If you choose this path, the world will be a darker place.
Frisha blinked away tears and murmured,
You say such things?
Rezkin dropped his hand and went back to his papers.
You should go. It is not appropriate for you to be in here alone with me.
She turned to leave and he said, Frisha?
Yes?
Please remain on the ship. We were lucky no one died when the O'Donnell Road took you.
Frisha inhaled and straightened her spine. She looked him in the eyes and said,
I'm going with you.
When he answered, his voice held a hard edge she was not used to hearing directed at her.
If you are taken again, I will slaughter all in my path to retrieve you.
The dark certainty in his gaze sent a chill up Frisha's spine as she was once again reminded that he was Dark Tidings, the Rez, and the Raven. Her mind, fears, and moral fortitude were at war with her heart, but when she remembered him saying that he could never love her, her heart lost. Frisha left the cabin and was immediately reprimanded by Malcius, who had managed to work his way past Zah without getting stabbed.
Every time you speak to him, you end up crying, Malcius said. Why do you not tell him you have changed your mind?
Frisha stared past the still, gray water near the dock to the darker blue of the ocean afar.
Because I have not, she said. It cannot be, Malcius. I'm sorry.
As she pushed past him, she added,
Perhaps you would be better to push Sheila on him after all. She would not care if he had no feelings.
The dockmistress did not return alone. An entire army platoon, flanked by royal guards, lined the docks, followed by the Ashayan and Chenarian ambassadors and four presumably high-ranking women dressed in palace livery, each sitting atop a glamorous white horse. Horns blared as the women rode side by side between the ranks of saluting soldiers. Rezkin turned from his porthole view of the ostentatious fanfare and donned his equally theatrical mask. He then joined his party on the deck. Isaria and Mage Threl led the way down the gangplank as Raylan, Frisha, the Minder, and Wesson followed behind Rezkin. The ambassadors, both men, stood back as the four women greeted Rezkin. They remained on their horses as they introduced themselves as members of the Queen's Court, Arisiel's most ardent supporters and advisors.
We are here to escort you to the palace,
the middle-aged blonde on the right said.
You should expect to spend several days in our company.
Under which diplomatic status am I to be received? Said Dark Tidings.
The woman's painted lips lifted at the corners.
That is to be decided by Queen Larissia.
Dark Tidings tilted his head.
Then warn her that it is in her best interest not to test me.
The redhead beside her said,
Bold wealth from and displaced from his kingdom.
I am often accused of boldness. The claim is not unwarranted. None who have chosen to test me have been disappointed.
The two who had spoken glanced toward the woman on the left, who had more gray than brown in her hair. She nodded, and the women drew their mounts to the side so that a carriage could be brought forward. Rezkin had no desire to be trapped in an enclosed carriage.
I will ride, he said.
The younger women looked to the older woman again, and at her direction, a horse was brought to him. Knowing the Lareshi were fervent for formality, he had already planned accordingly, and their trunks were ready for loading. Rezkin's companions piled into the carriage, which traveled behind him as he followed the women toward the palace. They rode slowly with the royal guard running beside them as they moved through the city. Each of the guards carried a tall pole topped by a massive colored flag slapping in the wind. While the flags were part of the fanfare, Rezkin knew they also served another purpose. Since the buildings were so tall and the Matrioneras vulnerable in the open, the flags were used to obscure them from onlookers and deflect or entangle projectiles. As they neared the palace, the buildings became spaced farther apart and had fewer levels, but they were just as colorful. The more opulent estates were surrounded by walls or gardens filled with statues and carved fountains, most of which depicted men serving or prostrating themselves before their matria. Some were of men in battle or women teaching other women, and it was not uncommon to see images of men and women engaging in acts of lovemaking. Women walked freely and confidently along the walkways, trailed by male and female retainers or family members. The men wore their hair at various lengths, but all had one long braided strand that hung from the temple. From her seat inside the carriage, Raylan leaned over Wesson to watch a group of men walk by unaccompanied by a woman. She said,
Why do they wear their hair like that?
Isiria said,
It indicates their status. A blue ribbon means a man belongs to the house of a Matrionera, but that he is not related to her or claimed as consort. A green ribbon means he is of relation to the Matrionera, but not a consort. A red one means he has been claimed by a Matria as consort. He will combine it with a blue or green one if his Matria is not the Matrionera. My father's was silver. You will not see many of those. After he escaped to Ashai with my mother, she claimed him as her husband, which meant she recognized him as her equal in the relationship. The women's ribbons have similar meanings. If a woman does not wear one, it means she is a Matrionera, or the head of her own house. Blue means she belongs to another's house, but is of no relation, and green means she is of relation to her Matrionera. Since my mother belonged to her older sister's house, she wore a green one. After she claimed my father as her husband, she added a silver, and when she established her own house in Ashai, she removed the green.
Nanasi said,
If a woman can establish her own house, why would she continue to belong to someone else's? So long as a woman belongs to another's house, she is entitled to physical and political protection and basic financial support from that house. If she declares her own house, she is giving up all the privileges of the other house.
Frisia said,
Then it is the same as staying in your family home in Ashai.
Yes, Isaria said hesitantly.
In Ashai, it is the man who establishes his own house, whereas here, it is the woman. A woman is required to serve her Matrionera, though, so many choose to leave if they do not want to serve another. Also, a woman cannot claim a man without her Matrionera's permission, so if she wants to claim someone otherwise, she must leave her Matrionera's house.
It sounds very complicated,
Nanasi said. Isaria shook her head.
Not really. A woman trades power and wealth for independence. If she is strong, her house will also become successful.
Nanasi watched as a young woman who looked like a maid scurried after her Matrionera. She said,
Not everyone can be a success, though. I imagine there are many who fail.
Isaria pulled her gaze from the same scene and said,
They return to their former Matrionera's house in disgrace. It is up to the Matrionera whether she will accept her back and what position the woman will hold. If the Matrionera does not accept, she may petition to join another's house,
but she will probably become no more than a servant. What about mages? Are there different rules?
Nanasi said.
Isaria shrugged. I believe it is the same, but someone who has enough talent to become a mage will usually have the wealth and abilities necessary to have her own house.
I do not understand why the men put up with it,
Wesson grumbled.
Isaria blinked at him in surprise.
This is the culture. The men have helped to define it as much as the women. My father was very dedicated to my mother. He would have served her for the rest of his life, whether she had claimed him as husband or not. It is a matter of personal honor for the men to belong to houses run by strong women, and they are devoted to ensuring their matrioneras and matrias achieve the greatest respect and recognition. The consort of a strong matria may be of higher status than a woman of a much lower house.
So the men are not just slaves?
Wesson said.
No, of course not. Women and men both engage in research, music, and the art, and they may dedicate themselves to a craft. While the women run the government, houses, and businesses, the men are free to pursue other interests for which they are better suited, like hunting, construction, or combat training. The Rishi men are great warriors. Champions are prized among the houses, so a man with strength and skill will be sought by many women.
Your father taught you the sword, even though you were a woman, said Frisha.
Yes, women may pursue these interests as well, but most choose not to because they are preoccupied with generating political support and wealth to become independent. In Ashai, everything was backward, and I would have had no chance to create a house of my own. My father had hoped that he could acquire enough wealth working for the Duke to see me through, at least until I married or returned to my family's house in Lonnoresh, but Atreus was not a generous employer. My father taught me the sword to protect myself, and because it was the one skill he knew best. If nothing else, I could join the army or work as a guard, assuming I found an employer to accept a woman.
Which you did,
Nanasi said with an encouraging smile. Sadness filled Isaria's green eyes.
Yes, but at a great cost.
Pallas wasn't your fault,
Raylan said.
Isaria turned her gaze toward the colorful flags and buildings.
But everyone agrees.
Rezkin rode ahead of the carriage, his vigilance intensified by the fact that he had already acquired two new daggers that had been generously tossed his way. It seemed not everyone was excited for his presence in the city. He did not believe the weapons to be a true attempt on his life, since anyone good enough to throw one with accuracy would know the amount of armor he wore would make it nearly impossible to land a fatal strike. The weapons were meant to serve as warnings or tests of his skill. In a land where people acquired their positions through challenge or assassination of their betters, such things were apparently commonplace. The palace was not located within the city proper. It sat atop a knoll, surrounded at its base by densely packed briars and soggy brine marshland that had been created artificially by a man-made canal that led from the sea. The canal was a deep, dry chasm at that time, though, the gates opening to fill it only when the marsh began to dry. The bridge that passed over the empty canal and marsh transitioned to a steep road with several switchbacks to make it possible for the carriage to travel safely. A stone stairway led straight up the side of the hill to the palace for those who desired a more direct foot route. The wall surrounding the grounds was not as tall as the walls of some cities, but due to the steep slope upon which it was built, it was still formidable. The elaborately decorated palace had three tall spires surrounding a central domed complex. The walls were made of white stone, and the wooden beams and balustrades were bleached white or blonde like driftwood. From every window fluttered curtains, banners, or flags, a bright contrast to the overcast sky. The four matrioneras who had escorted them from the docks guided the party from the courtyard entrance through several passages and stairwells within the main hold. The corridors were lined with guards, and curious onlookers gawked and giggled from farther down the blocked side passages. The corridors were painted different colors and bore tapestries, paintings, and sculptures to match a theme. A corridor painted the same yellow gold as the soldiers' tabards contained militaristic artwork with scenes of battles, presumably famous leaders, or weapons and armor, while a green corridor had portraits of men, women, and children, whom their guides identified as members of the Queen's family. It was in this passage that their third-floor suite was located, and it consisted of a sitting room and three bedchambers that they were apparently expected to share. Rezkin surveyed each of the rooms and then returned to their escorts. The Matrioneras had removed the overgowns of livery, and each was now displaying far more of herself than was appropriate in any of the kingdoms he had visited. He said, "Why are we assigned to this wing?" The blonde smirked.
"The queen does not trust us, of course. No one is permitted in this corridor except for her consort and family."
"Yet you are here," he observed.
"We made a deal for the honor of escorting you,"
she said, as she ran manicured fingers over her exposed midriff. Her pale blue silk skirt hung low on her hips, and the matching corset she wore, sans blouse, barely reached her lower ribs.
"What was the deal?" he asked.
"It is not important for you," she said. "You will not see us here again, but be assured that you will see us."
She strode closer and toyed with a loose lock of her wavy golden curls.
"Will you not remove your mask so that we may know you?"
"You should not be so eager to know me, Matrioneras."
"Talia,"
she smiled coyly and said.
"Why is that?"
"People who know me often do not survive."
Talia's expression faltered, and the brown-haired woman, who had been silently observing, finally spoke.
"We should go, Talia. Aristil will not be pleased that we have lingered in her wing." "But he has not yet given us his name,"
Talia said, as she looked back at him expectantly. Rezkin felt the buzz of mage power alight, but it did not come from Talia. It was the older gray-haired woman from whom the Vimara emanated. He said,
"I do not have a name."
The older woman inhaled sharply.
"He speaks truth."
Talia's smile quivered again.
"A nameless one? How fascinating."
Dark Tidings turned his black gaze to the older woman.
"You are a truth seeker?"
"I would not say that I seek the truth, only that I hear it,"
the woman said.
"I am Matrioneras the Elder. What kind of man does not have a name? Everyone in every kingdom is given a name at birth."
Dark Tidings cocked his head eerily and said,
"What gave you the impression that I am a man, or that I was born?"
"Let us go,"
said the brown-haired woman as she tugged at the redhead's arm. Matrioneras the Elder said,
"Yes, Talia, come. We will let Aristil know that he is here."
To Rezkin, she said,
"A feast is being prepared in honor of your arrival. You and your..."
Her eyes flicked to his companions.
"Guests will join us at 7 bells.
The women departed, and Rezkin gave the sign for Wesson to ward the room against eavesdropping. His survey also revealed 3 objects enchanted for that purpose, which Wesson quickly dismantled.
"What was that about not being born?"
Frisha said with a huff, as Rezkin removed his mask.
"Theatrix, Frisha. I do not want these women to become personally interested. It is better they fear me."
"Yes, Talia seemed very interested," she snapped.
"Matrioneras, Talia. Formalities are important here. You cannot drop a title unless you have one of equal or greater status."
"Fine," she said, "but I cannot believe they would walk around like that. They were practically spilling out of their clothes."
"Their sense of propriety is different here. In Lonaresh, a woman's body belongs only to her. She is not required to submit to anyone else's ideals of what is appropriate to do with it."
Raylan said,
"So a woman could strut naked down the corridor and no one could say anything?"
"Exactly,"
Rezkin said. "But they also use their feminine attributes to get what they want, so they do not tend to give away for free what they feel should be earned."
Frisher said, "What if a man tries to take something that she's not offering?"
"You will not find a place with harsher punishments for such a crime. For a man to attack a woman is torture and death."
"What if the man is innocent?"
Frisher said in horror. Rezkin said, "The truth seekers ensure the woman is not lying." Nanasi added,
"The Lareshi have the greatest number of truth-seekers in any of the kingdoms. I do not know of any in Ashai, but I hear there are dozens in Lonaresh." "What are truth-seekers?"
said Raylan.
"Their Vimara allows them to sense what is true. Some can see truth through enchantments, illusions, and disguises. Others can hear when someone speaks truth or lies, as Matrioneras the Elder demonstrated. This one is tricky, though, because it is dependent on whether the person speaking the lie believes it to be true."
Frisha shivered.
"So, Matrioneras the Elder will know if we are lying?"
Raylan said,
Then why did she believe you when you said you didn't have a name?
Nanasi seemed just as perplexed. Because I do not, he said.
But your name is Reskin,
Raylan said. Reskin is not my name. It is what some people call me. Minder Finwë said,
How is it that you do not have a name?
I was not given one at birth, Reskin said. He pointed to a stained glass door through which they could see a deep pit set in the floor surrounded by colorful bottles and stacks of drying cloths. He said, There is a bathing chamber. We have been traveling a long while. You should all take advantage of the luxury before the feast.
But anyone can see in, Frisher exclaimed.
Journeyman Wesson, Minder Finwë, and I will remain in my bedchamber until you are finished. They will share the room with me, and the four of you can divvy up the other two.
I will stay at the temple, Finwë said. I've never visited the temple of the Maker in Lon Luresh, and many Lureshi are said to be highly devout.
He bowed, collected his single traveling pack, and departed.
I can sleep in the sitting room, Wesson said. Actually, I would prefer it.
Reskin gave him a quizzical look, but shrugged with indifference. Very well, but you will come to my room while the women bathe.
Of course,
Wesson said, as his cheeks flushed. A few hours later, a knock sounded at the door. Doing his best to appear meek and inconsequential, Wesson answered, wearing plain gray mage robes. A young woman was bent with her rump in the air, picking up items that had spilled from a basket that looked rather too large for her to carry. He cleared his throat, and the woman squeaked in surprise as she jumped and spun to face him.
Iskeshiletua,
she babbled in a rush. Wesson scratched his temple and looked at her curiously. She was close to his age, with large, brown doe eyes and mousy brown hair pulled back into a long braid that hung past her waist. A thinner braid, intertwined with a green ribbon, hung from her temple. Her pink silk bodice barely covered her breasts, and her filmy skirt was split up one side to her hip. Her eyes were shadowed, her lashes darkened, and her full lips painted to glossy pink perfection. He clasped his hands behind his back to keep from fidgeting and said,
I'm afraid I do not speak Lureshi.
Oh,
the young woman said as she blinked back at him. Slowly, with her brow furrowed in concentration, she said,
Sorry to you. My words of Ashai are not good.
He nodded, but remembered not to smile, since he did not want to encourage unwanted attention.
I bring dress,
she said, and then frowned.
Dresses for dinner.
Ah, Wesson said, and then stood aside to let her enter. As she moved to pick up the basket, he stepped forward to assist. Each of them took a handle, and they bumped and stumbled through the doorway, nearly spilling the basket's contents again. The woman smiled and thanked him, and then stared at him expectantly. He scratched his head again.
I guess I will get the women.
The woman smiled and nodded, so Wesson knocked on Frisch's door. She and Mage Threl answered together, and Wesson motioned over his shoulder.
The lady has brought you some dinner clothes.
Both women came forward slowly, eyeing the basket as if it were a poisonous snake. Wesson next alerted Isaria and Raylan, who looked equally skeptical of the basket's contents. The young woman introduced herself as Selyse, and then began enthusiastically holding up strips of silky fabric, none of which looked large enough to cover any intimate details. Frisha said,
Don't you have anything that covers... You know, more?
Selyse looked at her in confusion, and then Isaria rattled off some words in Lureshi. Selyse smiled and dug through the basket to pull out a long violet frock that would fit snugly but would cover from the neck to the toes. Unfortunately, it was completely sheer. Frisha looked at it in horror. Nanasi said,
Perhaps if we layer them?
No, Frisha said, absolutely not. I will wear my own clothes.
Selyse eyed Frisha's burgundy gown dubiously. While it would not have been appropriate court dress in Ashai, it was certainly an acceptable dinner dress. Raylan reached into the basket and pulled out a long, chocolate-brown drape that seemed to have no shape, ties, or straps.
What do you do with this?
She asked. Selyse took the fabric and began wrapping it around Raylan over her tunic and pants. It wrapped over one shoulder, cut across the breasts, twisted around the hips, and then tucked into itself at the hip. Wesson thought that one firm tug would pull the entire garment off. His face heated at the thought.
I
I will be in the king's room, he stuttered.
When he turned to leave, he nearly ran into the man himself. Dressed as dark tidings, Rezkin hovered behind the Lareshi woman. She jumped back as he came around to peer into the basket. He plucked a dark green bustier from the pot.